Start moving.
It's so funny. It's a joke she came up with. Okay.
Is it moving?
Yep. Ready?
Go.
All right, guys, welcome back. Marcia Stone, alcoholic, drug addict.
Hey, Marcia.
Hey, everybody. We're going to spend some time in this next little bit talking about making a third step decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand God. You know, there's lots of jokes that get made about this third step deal, and I 100% get it, because for all those years, you could not have convinced me that alcohol and drugs were not my problem. You know, it was shocking information to me when all of a sudden now we're going to start talking about the root of my problem being selfishness and self-centeredness. And, you know, I mean, this is sort of kindergarten-level information, but for me it was like, you know, it blew my hair back that when they were saying to me, you know, selfishness in this regard, Marcia, doesn't mean I'm not going to share my Starbucks with him because I'll do that, you know. Selfishness means being completely consumed with self. It's not that I think too much of myself. It's not that I think too little of myself. It's just that I'm thinking too often of myself and how every single thing in the whole universe affects me and revolves around me, and how is this going to impact me and my plans and designs. I think I mentioned it earlier. I'm sponsoring this woman now, and she's got about 9 years sober, but she's not been participating in the recovery process. In fact, when I was going through step three with her, and we eventually made the third step decision and did the third step prayer on our knees, she opened her eyes back up, and she just had tears coming down her face, and she said, I never knew this. I never knew this. And the truth of the matter is, you know, if you're sitting in this room, you have been introduced to the circle within the circle. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is, you know, I believe it's your obligation to go out and to help other people and to introduce them to this recovery process in the way that it's been introduced to all of us, to really explain to people what the first step actually means. Mm-hmm. To really explain to people, you know, how do you actually work a second step and make a conception, and then how do you take that information and those experiences and bring those into a real third step decision and start to really begin to identify how self manifested in various ways is what defeats us, mm-hmm. because it is. Somebody stopped me in the break and said, you know, I'm so grateful that you were shaking my tree and talking to me about my current unmanageability and what that means. And another way of saying that is, how is self-will currently manifesting in your life today? You know, and the lady that I'm sponsoring, this is kind of a silly example, but I'll share it with you. Before we did the third step, you know, one of the first times I met with her, I was just asking her, so, you know, what's going on with you? You know, like, why do you want to go through the steps? You've been, you know, abstinent from alcohol all this time. And she said, well, I've got a problem with the spatula in my kitchen. Mm. And I said, well, what's going on with the spatula? And she said, well, my husband and my daughter and my son, when they make scrambled eggs, they don't clean the dried eggs off of the spatula before they put it in the dishwasher, even though I've told them numerous times that this really is bothering me, and they just don't care. They don't care that this is the right way to do it. And I said, well, so what did you do about that? She said, well, I was really just stewing about it for months, and I was going behind them and cleaning the eggs off the spatula and washing it again, and it was just really making me angry. And then finally, I just decided that there was another solution. And I said, well, what was the solution? You know, to maybe go through the steps and do some inventory about that? She said, no. I just went down to the Bed Bath & Beyond and bought me another spatula and put that in a totally separate drawer. And I said, well, that is a solution. But you know, I would say to you that that there's another way to go about interrupting self-will. And there's another way to go about seeing how your selfishness and your self-centeredness is being driven and you're stepping on the toes of your family, right? When we talk about step three and we start really talking about this selfishness and self-centeredness part, it brings us to page 62, and I'm just going to read this paragraph. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we've made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above all, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. So sometimes I think we read those two paragraphs or that paragraph and a half so much that it almost sounds like how it works, like, you know? But if you really look at that, especially that last sentence where it says, above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. And again, remember, selfishness is not unwillingness to share. Selfishness is absolute just consumption with self. Consumption. And, you know, it's so funny. Like, I can identify the selfishness in you, in him, in my sponsees, in the people I work with, but I'm the last one to see it in myself. Self cannot see self. Self cannot see self. But it kills us, whether we see it or not. So when it says, God makes that possible, right? So God can remove our obsession to put alcohol, to put drugs into our body, which has been our treatment for selfishness up until this point. God can remove that, but how? But how does that happen? And how does that stay happen? And that's kind of what we're talking about today. So when we have this sentence that says, our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. Notice the book does not say, our troubles are basically of Jack Daniel's making. It does not say our troubles are of heroin's making. It does not even say our troubles are of trauma's making. It says our troubles are of our own making. So, do I have trauma? Yes, I do. Do I have alcoholism? Yes, I do. Are those two things making the trouble currently in my life? No, they're not. Selfishness, consumption with self, trying to arrange the world to better myself and my position are 100% of the time what caused my troubles. Whether we're talking about a spatula that's covered with dried eggs, or whether we're talking about a competitor in the business world that I think needs to poof off the face of the planet, whether we're talking about Jonathan playing too much Clash Royale for my liking, whatever is out there, whatever is out there that's driving me to do my very best to arrange my life in a way that will suit me is evidence of my problems being of my own making. So why is that? Why above most people? Because it says here that the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. Why is that? Why does not say people are extreme examples of self-will run riot? It doesn't. It says the alcoholic. So if alcoholics, by their very nature, are consumed with self, then by default that means that we are all under the delusion that we're going to be happy and satisfied if we manage our external situation well to please ourselves. And oh, by the way, you too, although that's a way distant second. Right? Way distant second on my list. So if I'm alcoholic and I'm self-centered by nature and I'm doing my best to control the world to better myself and my position, What are the statistical chances, my math numbers people in here, what are the statistical chances that that's going to happen well 100% of the time? Zero? A, I don't know what I want. What's going to make me happy? B, I'm playing puppeteer, or another word of saying that is I'm playing God, trying to arrange life to suit me. It's never going to work out. So why does it say that this selfishness is what kills me? Because selfishness is unchecked, without inventory, without the recovery process, is what leads to unmanageability, is what, as we talked about this morning, leads back to mental obsession and back to allergy. So the first interrupter of all that is this third step, right? Before now, we've been looking at our relationship with alcohol and drugs, looking at our relationship with unmanageability, with those feelings that are the result of unmanageability, that are, oh, by the way, a result of selfishness. And we've been looking at our relationship with God. So now we're going to be taking all of that momentum and looking at turning our will and our life, which is our thoughts and our actions, over to the care of this new power. We're about to resign. We're about to resign from trying to run our own life in a way that we think is going to make us better and happier, that always ends in frustration and loneliness and despair, and always leads us back to the first one.
Thanks, Marcia. Jonathan, I'm an addict.
Hey, Jonathan.
And, I was thinking as Marcia was going, I was just kind of thinking about what we talked about so far, and you know, I hope that there's still some newcomers in the room, and even if there's not, I think this is applicable for people that, you know, have tons of years of sobriety, but I think I talked about it last night. I can't remember when, but, you know, the truth is this. For every single person in this room, you can reflect back, whether it was yesterday or whether it was 25 years ago, of your last interaction with your drug of no choice. Whether it's, alcohol, coke, weed, meth, heroin, whatever. But we all have a separation event that happened. Whether it was overdose or detox or swinging on a cop or, you know, whatever it was. I mean, something separated us from alcohol and drugs for the last time. And what I've come to realize through my own experience, as well as through sponsoring lots of people, is that from that moment of last separation, we all have windows of opportunity. And our windows, unfortunately, close at different rates for different people. Some people's window may stay open 2 weeks. Some people's window may stay open 9 years. Some people's window may stay open 6 months. But my job, once I'm separated from alcohol and or drugs, is to draw some conclusions while my window is still open. Unfortunately, if my window shuts before I have the opportunity or make the most of my opportunity to draw these conclusions, it's very difficult for me to get my window back open without smoking more crack or drinking more whiskey. And, you know, we're in the third part of what I see as the necessary conclusions that I have to come to while my window is open. While my window's open, I've got to take a look at my first step, at the truth about my relationship with my drug of no choice. And then I have to come to the conclusion that there is some power out there that I could possibly tap into to prevent the return of insanity around my drug of no choice. And then the third conclusion that I've got to come to is this third step realization. And guys, I'm telling you, again, from my experience sponsoring and my own, you know, personal experience, if you can get these three solid while your window is open, it somehow magically keeps the window open a little longer. If it shuts, it's dicey. It's very dicey. And, you know, the one thing I've seen people, you know, I used to think that people that relapse, they relapse because they never had a first step. I no longer believe that, because I've had people that I know to the depths of my soul have had sincere you know, soul-shattering first-step experiences. But they've incrementally backed away from that, fall back asleep to it, and end up putting whiskey back into their body, despite having a clear first step. The other common place, though, where I see people get disconnected or don't come to this while their window is still open is this requirement for the third step. And the requirement for the third step, you know, is on page 60. And it's right after the ABCs, and it says, being convinced of what? Of those ABCs. Being convinced of the ABCs, I am at step three, which is that I decide to turn my will and my life over to God as I understood Him. Just what do I mean by that, and just what do I do? The next sentence is what trips lots of people up. The first requirement, which implies that there's a requirement. That's how I interpret that. The first requirement is that I be convinced that my life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Now, I really wish that it said this. The first requirement is that Jonathan be convinced that he smoked too much crack. Yeah. Now, I can sign on to that, right? Or there's a requirement that I be convinced that I drank too much whiskey, right? It doesn't mention drugs or alcohol in the slightest. It casts a much bigger net that's a lot harder to get clear on than just I drank too much or I smoked too much, right? My life run on my will can hardly be a success. That is a difficult concession to come to. Because there were, for a long time, I could really get with the idea that I excessively did drugs and alcohol. But I, again, the ego's natural response is to defend itself. And so I would immediately point toward all of my so-called accomplishments. Well, I know I smoked crack and drank whiskey and burned my life down, but I graduated from vet school. So, right? I mean, who cares if I'm a veterinarian if I'm smoking crack in the damn surgery suite? No one's giving me, you know, a blue ribbon for that, right? My life run on my will hasn't worked up to this point, isn't currently working, and is most likely not going to work in the future. That's the conclusion that I have to draw based on, again, my life resume. It's almost like, you guys remember in We Agnostics, I think it says laying aside the drink question. Mm. They say why living is so unsatisfactory. And so laying aside my experience with drugs and alcohol, although that's what it's always about, laying aside my experience with drugs and alcohol, I've got to take a good hard look at the way that I've been managing my life. And the truth is this. If I was able to pull 100 people off the street and show them a highlight reel of some of the best decisions that I thought I've made in my own best interest, all 100 of them would run screaming the other way, saying whoever's responsible for making decisions for this guy needs to be fired from that position, right? I did go to vet school. I did get through that 4-year military school. You know, I am a husband. I am a father. I am a stepfather. But none of that in and of itself fixed what was wrong with me to the extent that I didn't feel compelled to drink whiskey and smoke crack. And I've got to get with the idea that I need new management for my life. And the main driving force behind my so-called bad decisions in managing my life was this selfishness and self-centeredness that they're talking about in this step. I've made decisions sometimes with good motives, but always underlying it was my selfishness, my self-centeredness, my tendency to think that I know what's best for me in a given situation, my tendency to think that I know what's best for you in the same situation. And that's what I've got to do. This third step is a push all your eggs into one basket step. You know, what I've noticed as the time has gone on, and again, sponsoring tons of people and, you know, having, you know, lots of experience myself with failing and doing it, you know, wrong, is that there's a tendency to compartmentalize my third step decision. Mm-hmm. Meaning, God, thank you so much for taking away my crack and my alcohol problem. I really needed that. But, and, you know, I'll give you my marriage, but I'm real clear that I don't need help parenting. Mm-hmm. Or I'll give you the parenting, but I'm going to go ahead and keep in charge of my own money. And the problem with the compartmentalization of the third step is I don't know if it's possible to reach that place that is so vital for me to get to called safe and protected. Because if I'm still in charge of certain areas of my life, the implication is I've got enough power. Thanks very much. And if the belief system that I'm operating under is that I have enough power, then that's going to be reflected in the actions that I take. And all of a sudden, if the scale is here, I'm going to be participating at a level of a recreational crack smoker when I'm really the real deal. Right? And that's a mismatch, and that spells misery at the least and smoking crack like a mofo at the worst. Right? So, you want to do more on three?
Yeah, I was just thinking when you were talking about that, what I really refer to as my first third step experience, you know, I went to treatment and they did a really good job at a lot of stuff. And I remember that we had sort of like worksheets that were, you know, about the 12 steps, and we all just kind of copied off each other's answers and turned them in real fast. And,
make an A.
Yeah, like, you know, it was like a fill-in-the-blank kind of situation where you, like, read through and then you, like, flip through and, like, oh, there's the word, and that goes in, and then we all just, like, that. That was kind of what was going on. And it was very convenient because right across the street from where we live was this, like, clubhouse, and we had to go to a certain number of meetings a week. So we just kind of, like, went there and sat all together and kind of, like, gossiped and picked our nails and waited to go outside and smoke cigarettes. And you know, I wasn't really getting a whole lot out of that process at the time, looking back. But at least I was in my seat and I was going through treatment and I was not using or drinking. But I had had such a relapse history that I was really hungry for change. And I remember that I had been in treatment for about 20 days. And when Jonathan was talking about that window, I know that back then my window was about 20 days. So I was 20 days removed from alcohol, 20 days removed from drugs, 20 days removed from my partner in crime, 20 days removed from being around my kids, my job, all the things that define me. And I'm sitting there in treatment, looking at resigning my license, you know, looking in the rearview mirror that my life has blown up one more time, and really, you know, sitting with that whole idea of being constitutionally incapable. And at the 20-day mark, I go to my neighbor that's, like, in the little room beside me, and I say to her, like, you know, I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. Like, you know, I crawling out of your skin and all those feelings, and you just want to get high and all that stuff, and there's no solution in drugs anymore because they're not there, and there's no solution in the steps because I'm not there. And I was just looking back on it, it was a miserable place to be. And like I was saying earlier when I was talking, now that I have experience with this book and how to help people with the first and second step, for the rest of my life, I've made a commitment to God and to everybody else that that's what I will do. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, looking back at that 20-day mark that I'm about to describe, it could have gone either way, you know. But anyway, I went to my neighbor and I said to her, like, you know, I can't do this. I know treatment's not going to work. I have all this evidence that treatment's not going to work, and I got to go. You know, like, I got to get my $50 that are in my, like, PA account. And I got to go, you know. I mean, I didn't know this at the time, but I had to go get high. Like, I needed some relief right then. And she said to me, and she's, like, we're literally one of the craziest people I know. I'm still friends with her today. So the fact that this came out of her mouth is, like, nothing short of a vital spiritual experience. And those of you in the room that knew I'm talking about, like, everyone's like, mm-hmm. So she says to me, she said, have you prayed about that? And it was like she was speaking Japanese to me, you know? I was like, what does that have to do with anything? Like, right. I told you, I've got to go get my money out of the PA account to go. And she was like, well, you know, it's dark. And it was May 26th, you know, right here in Atlanta. She's like, it's dark, you know, and the office is closed. And, you know, don't you think it'd be better to just do that tomorrow? And, you know, while you're at it, while you're here, why don't you just pray about that? And I was like, okay, it is dark. And then I went back in my room, and I was just so broken, y'all. And I remember I was just face down, like in the fetal position, like on the shag carpet, just bawling my eyes out, you know, just bawling my eyes out, and really just starting to say things to this, you know, this God that I didn't even think even knew where I was, you know. And I was just like, God, I just cannot do this anymore. And that was, you know, that was what, like, the most guttural sound that was coming out of me at the time. And, you know, I was led, I kind of opened my eyes, and I looked across the room, and I saw this book there that I had asked my friends to send to me. I actually asked them to send me my big book, but they didn't know what that was, so they just sent, like, this relapse book.
Relapse prevention.
Yeah, relapse prevention. It's kind of appropriate. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, Gorski. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with that. Whoever's listening to this tape. And and I was just led to open that book, and I opened that book, and it just fell open to a page, and it said, If you think you're constitutionally incapable, that is a lie of your disease. If you find yourself in a treatment setting, roll up your sleeves and do the work. And that was the first moment in time that I ever knew for a fact that God was interested in me and my recovery. And what I want to say to you all and to whoever listens to this tape in the future is that God is just as interested in you and in your recovery as he is in me or my recovery. The only thing that prevents me from experiencing that is this umbrella of self-will that I carry around when I compartmentalize that decision, like Jonathan was talking about. And I can, like, use that umbrella like a shield. You're not going to touch my job. You're not going to touch my marriage. You know, you're not going to touch my money. But at that time, you know, y'all, I was crying. I couldn't stop crying. I was, like, telling everybody that I knew, and I was crying, and everybody in the community was looking at me like, you have lost your mind. But, you know, in this book, what I know for sure is that really what happened there, because I've never had anybody to take me through the book at that point in time, but I really worked steps 1, 2, and 3 on my knees that night. And this book says the wording is quite optional. The wording is quite optional. My wording sounded like, God, I can't do this anymore. Some people's wording sounds exactly like the third step prayer that's written here. Both are beautiful. The most important thing is that the first requirement has been met. At that moment, I realized that my life, run on my will, had not been and would never be a success. Marcia Stone, swinging for the fences every day. I wind up in jail, in detox, with all kind of bad consequences happening because of my relationship with my drugs of no choice. So at that moment in time, I made one decision and one decision only. And it wasn't really that I was going to have this profound relationship with God that was going to carry me on for years and years. It was simply that I was going to do what that book said, that I was going to roll up my sleeves and do the work. And so I made the decision right then and there that I was going to do whatever they told me to do in treatment. Then later, that decision carried me to connecting with a sponsor that connected me with this book. All those things were related, one thing after another. But it all started with that very, very black moment in time, that dark moment where I felt like there was absolutely no way out, and I reached out to this power that I really didn't even have a relationship with at all, looking back. So, you know, when people are walking up to their third step decision, based on my own experience, I give them the grace to be sad, to be scared, to feel whatever they're feeling. Because if you really understand what you're about to be doing, and the book even says, we think well before we take this vital step. Mm-hmm. Once you make a real third step decision, your life is never the same. Mm-hmm. It is never the same. I'll never forget one time when after I started working for Mark Houston. It's hot in Texas. All right, let's just get that out. It's hot. Mm. The first summer that I was there, I remember I like snatched my suitcase off the closet. I was like, fuck this, Johnson. We're moving. I mean, it's hot. Born in Georgia, but y'all ain't got nothing on Texas. I'm telling you right now. And one day I was out there. It was hot, and I was talking to Mark. I was like, Mark, my God, you know, why did you have to make Mark Houston Recovery in Maine or Texas? Like, why couldn't we be in Malibu right now? Mm-hmm. Mark Houston said to me, once you make a real third step decision, where you live is no longer any of your business, Marcia. And that rocked me to my core, you know? Mm-hmm. I still snatched my suitcase down off the shelf, but I knew it was just a fit that we weren't going anywhere, you know? Mm-hmm. And whether it's where you live, whether it's what you do for a living, whether it's, you know, what's happening in your immediate life, you might not understand it. But when you've made a third step decision, when your primary purpose switches at some point to staying sober and helping other alcoholics and addicts, like the logistics and the details are of really no consequence. Mm-hmm. And just to the extent that I'm trying to run my life and set it up in a way that seems good to me, because I don't know what's good and what's not good anymore, you know, or what's going to be beneficial to me. That's just to the extent that I've really lost touch with my first, second, and third step. And that's when the problems really mm-hmm. start to mount up and become impossibly difficult to solve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, too, you know, I can't emphasize enough what Marcia said. You know, if you're in the room under the impression that making a third step decision is going to fill you with like some bliss and you know, peace of mind and contentment, that wasn't my experience. You know, if you're like me and like most addicts and alcoholics that I've worked with, essentially, however chronologically old you are, what you're deciding to do is turn your back on the only way that you've ever known how to manage your own life. And in the summer of 2008, I can't tell you specifically what time it was, but it was sometime in June of 2008, I made a third step decision. And I made this decision with tears running down my face. And it looked something like this. You know, you guys that heard my story heard, you know, my veterinary license was gone, Marcia was gone, custody of the children was gone, house was gone, cars were gone, money was gone, everything was gone. All these self-appointed roles that I had assigned myself were no longer applicable in my life. And, you know, to some extent, I think that's what needed to happen, and it made this third step decision easier, although it was still just as painful. But I said to myself up on that hill in Manor, Texas, I said, out by the pool, I said, dear God, you know, I really love my wife, and I hope that we can reconcile. But if having her around me is going to prevent me from progressing in my recovery, keep her the hell away from me. And I desperately, my arms ache for my kids. I really want to see my kids again. But if having them in my life is going to prevent me from staying close to you and performing your work well, keep them away from me. And the only thing I know how to do in my life is be a veterinarian. You can ask her. I mean, I burn shit up. I mean, I can change a light bulb and like operate a screwdriver, and that's about it. It's not like I have some, you know, backdoor plan of like maybe working HVAC or working on engines. I mean, I'm just not a handyman. But I told God, I said, you know, all I know how to do is be a veterinarian. But if continuing in that profession is going to interfere with my reliance on you and my ability to stay close to you and perform your work well, then show me something different to do. And that was a very scary decision to make. But I was so crystal clear that it needed to be made. And the reason there was so much emotion behind it is because it was a sincere decision. And it was heartfelt. And I knew for sure, because I had the experience of thinking I had what I needed and it not providing what I thought that it would. So in other words, Marcia was in my life, but that didn't fix what was wrong with me. Having custody of my kids and being a father didn't prevent me from drinking whiskey and smoking crack and being selfish around my children. And having the ability to practice my profession obviously didn't fix what was wrong with me either. And so I really laid all those things on the chopping block, and I was willing to have them all exit my life. And the way that it ended up, you know, going is about 9 months later, Marcia came back, and about, you know, I went 12 full months without seeing any of my kids. And then 12 months later, the kids started trickling back. And then, you know, after I went and I worked as a veterinary technician for 12 months, making $8 or $9 an hour, Mark Houston helped me get my veterinary license back. So all those things eventually came back into my life, but I had no clarity on whether they would or not when I made that decision. But that decision, guys, and I wish I could tell you here, 10 years sober, that I would make the exact same decision. But it's hard, you know? My window was open. My window was open when I made that decision, and I was willing to resign as manager of my life. And that willingness came from the desperation that I felt in the summer of 2008. And like I said, you know, things have. I mean, nowadays, I always revisit my third step, and believe me, I have lots of experience with compartmentalizing and giving him this, but keeping this back, or, you know, changing my mind about this, or depending on how badly I want something to happen, that's the one that I need to keep away from God, because I feel like I can get myself a little better deal than God can in certain areas of my life. But, you know, that's the constant struggle, you know, is this idea that this delusion that I'm going to get myself a better deal, that I know what's best for me compared to God knowing what's best for me. And that's the struggle in terms of trying to keep my third step non-compartmentalized today at 10 years sober. So anyway, that's all I got about three.
So on page 63, I'll just say the third step prayer out loud. And then we can, if you want to, we can do some questions, or we can do the break.
Whatever. Do the break.
Okay. On page 63 in the middle, this is the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. Of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life, may I do thy will always. And then it says what I was talking about earlier. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. I'd like to, before we take our next break, I'd like to pose for your consideration. What would your life look like today, if you were to at last abandon yourself utterly to the power that you call God? What would that look like? You know, when we started this today, we were talking about questions like, do you want to live? Are you willing to participate in this spiritual program of action called recovery? in order to live? What does your behavior say? Not your intentions, but your actions. What does your behavior say about your willingness to live through this spiritual program of action? If you've been in recovery for a while and you've made the third step, what does your behavior say about whether or not you've abandoned yourself utterly to this power called God? I think in theory, like philosophically, we can all say, well, you know, God always has, you know, higher ideals, goals, whatever. My best life. God always has the higher good for me and everybody else. But how do we act that out in real life? You know, that's one of the questions to really ask yourself. One of the things that I've been sitting with recently is this idea of an abundance mindset over a scarcity mindset, and about how the God that I believe in, the Spirit of the universe, wants the best for me in every area of my life, every single area. But likewise, that God wants the best for all of you in every single area of your lives. So how does a scarcity mindset conflict with that? If I have a scarcity mindset, then what that says is I've got to get mine. Because if I don't get mine, you guys are going to get mine. But that's inconsistent with the true third step decision. Mm-hmm. And my belief, and my written and stated and heartfelt belief, that the Spirit of the universe has all of our highest good in mind at all times. By default, that is an abundance mindset. So one thing for us to look at is how does our humanness, how does our selfishness conflict with the universal truths? And furthermore, with spiritual principles, which we're going to talk about in the next hour.
And I was just going to say, we'll wrap up and have another vape break right now, but Marsha poses a good consideration lots of times that I think is good. It's good for me to sit with, and I'd like you guys to sit with it too, and that is that if my life was a silent movie, could people tell that I was in recovery? No words. Just watch my feet. And that's something that usually you'll make some buttholes pucker. So, all right, we'll see you guys at 3.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So,
okay, it's going.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Marsha Stone, alcoholic, drug addict.
Hi, Marsha.
Hey, everybody. So we're going to talk for a few minutes about balking points, because there are some, and they keep us from being connected to our first step and possibly even keep us from maintaining our abstinence. And I'm going to do this really quickly, and then we're going to move into some practicing principles and affairs conversations. So, you know, when we think about balking points, the things that most often come to mind based on experience is inventory. Sitting on unwritten inventory is a major balking point, especially when you've been in recovery for some period of time. You know, we get this delusion like, oh, it's not a big deal. That doesn't really bother me. I'm just going to call my sponsor and talk about it. But staying connected to your first step really implies that you have a real clear, visceral understanding with the statement, my problems are of my own making. So that means when you're writing inventory that you're not looking for, quote, your part and, quote, their part. What you're looking for is how your problems are of your own making and how manifestations of self in that extended third column are blocking you from a connectedness to power. If I cannot be connected, if the God within me can't connect with the God within Lindsay, then that means that I'm blocked, and that's because of some version of self. Self manifested in various ways is what defeated us. But when we're talking about The Big Book gives us three specific warnings about drinking again, about using again. And the first one is on page 70, and it's talking about our sex conduct, our conduct in relationships. And it says here, when it's talking about continuing to harm people, if we're sorry for what we've done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we'll be forgiven and we'll have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts of our own experience. And some of you guys have been around long enough to really have an understanding and have some experience with sex conduct, inventory, not being about necessarily the person that you're in a sexual relationship with or have been in a sexual relationship with, although that's the basis. But those same questions can be really utilized in any relationships that you have. So in my mind, at least, it would seem that this warning would apply to any relationships that you have. If we continue to harm God's other kids, we are sure to drink again. That's what this book says. The second warning is on page 72. And this is talking about when we're doing our fifth step. You know, it says that a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient. That means just writing inventory and not sharing it with someone who's willing to tell you the truth about your alcoholism or your addiction won't fit the bill at all. It says here, many of us, there's no, in actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons why we should do so. The best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not ever come drinking. So staying current on inventory, staying current on sharing inventory is absolutely necessary in staying connected to your first step. The second balking point that I wanted to talk about briefly is the amends process. For some reason in Alcoholics Anonymous and in Cocaine Anonymous, there seems to be a lot of unnecessary confusion about amends. It's not that complicated, although our alcoholic and addict brains will complicate a two-car funeral, as my mother used to say. But, you know, it's necessary to make your amends. You know, Mark Houston was the one who taught us, is it possible that unfinished amends have something to do with putting whiskey back in your body? You know, do you want to stay sober and live free? And you are not others. Mm. Right? Except for when to harm others. You're not others. You're not. They're others. You're you. You're the offender. It says here, we must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink if we are afraid to face them. So in this section, it's obviously specifically talking about creditors, but, you know, unfinished amends, really when you boil it down, means that you're not clean with everybody. That there's an obstacle, like I was talking about, to the God within me, connecting with the God within that person that I've harmed or offended or shorted in some way. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the scariest amends that I had to make in my own history was to the judges and to the lawyers that I practiced with back in Asheville, North Carolina. And right before I went to treatment for the last time, the district court judges got together with the North Carolina Bar Association, essentially, and performed and did an intervention on me. And it was a heartfelt intervention, but my mind at the time was so warped that I was convinced that these people were just trying to, you know, target me and ruin my career and ruin my life, and they were somehow picking on me or they were stalking me or obsessed with me, and it was just crazy delusion stuff. But I really caused a lot of damage to them and to my clients that I had when I was, you know, basically practicing law while in active addiction. And so when I got sober, you know, one of the things that I had to do was to contact all of them pay back the money that I'd stolen from clients that the Bar Association had to cover. It was a hefty sum. And I had to, ask them what I could do to make it right. And, of course, we went through that whole process, and they kind of said the things that, you hope and pray people will say, like, just keep doing what you're doing, which was, a great relief at the time. But what came out of that was what I really wanted to talk about for a second. Within the last 3 years, I've had you guys know I work in the treatment business. I want to talk about that in just a second. But in the last 3 years, I've had the opportunity to treat in the treatment center that Jonathan and I own, the child of one of my biggest clients that I screwed over the most because of my alcoholism. She was able, because I was willing to make the amends to her, to call me when her child was suffering from addiction and to ask for my help and to receive the help that I was able to give her. Her daughter is sober today. Another person that I was able to help was I had what they call a mentor that was supposed to help me with my own recovery while I was practicing. And, I put him through the ringer big time, ducking and dodging and lying and
falsifying. Catch me if you can.
Yeah, catch me if you can. But he actually relapsed a couple of years ago, and he and the Bar Association reached out to me. And the guy that was my mentor, that was part of my intervention, actually came down to Texas, and we were able to help him with his recovery too. And neither one of those things would have been possible if I had fallen under this delusion that I was an others and I would be harmed if I were to go to them and tell them the truth about everything that happened because of my active addiction when I was involved in their lives. So, unwritten inventory, ungiven inventory in a fifth step, and unfinished amends are major balking points. And again, I just want to stress, the longer I'm away from my last drink or my last drug, the more likely I'm going to fall under the delusion that I got this and I can handle this. And, I already know what she's going to say when I call her, kind of thinking. And those are balking points, and those are the things that keep me disconnected from my first step and really make me susceptible to falling into untreated alcoholism. I'll turn it over to you, and then I'll circle back.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, too, I had one brief amends story. In the fall of 2008, when I was making my amends list off my eight-step list and my inventory, something that came that was very clear to me is, when I owned my own animal hospital, through a series of mistakes, the lady that I bought the practice from was not taken off the lease, which is, bad news for her. Because, when I started smoking crack in the surgery suite of the animal hospital, the North Carolina Veterinary Medical Board decided to go ahead and shut her down for me and padlock the door. So all of a sudden, all the inventory, all the surgery equipment, all the medical equipment, everything that was on lease essentially got repossessed, and she was left footing the bill because she was never taken off the lease just through a series of mistakes. So it's fairly clear that I caused some harm there. And so I wrote her a letter in the fall of 08, and I said, her name was Christina, and I said, I sent her an email, and I just said, Christina, this is Jonathan Stone, and, I'm clean and sober now, and I'm trying to, repair damage that I've caused. I'm pretty sure that I've caused you some harm. Would you reach out to me and, let me know what I can do to make things right? This was fall of 2008, and so 2009 passes, 2010, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. I totally forgot that I had even written that letter. And finally, January 2016 comes around, I get an email from Christina. And, she says, what you can do is you can pay me back the $40,000 that you owe me. And, my first thought was I wanted to look in these amends pages for a statute of limitations. In my mind, if she really needed the money, she should have asked in 09. She's going to wait 7 years? You know, I mean. But, you know, very quickly after I had that thought, you know, I called my sponsor. And, you know, I didn't make terms with her and end up paying her back because I'm a good guy. I didn't do that because of my conscience, you know. I did that because in 2016, when I agreed to make the reparations, I was crystal clear that if I blew that off, I would smoke crack and drink whiskey again. If you cannot, especially scary amends, if you're not convinced that not making them will lead you to put alcohol and drugs back in your body, there's a handful of amends that you won't make. It'll just be too scary. And it'll just be too inconvenient. You know, at the end of the day, I've got to sit here and realize that I have two options. I can pay this lady back, or I can smoke crack again. There's not a door number three, as badly as I want there to be. And so I ended up paying her some amount monthly in August of last year. I paid her off, and that was my last, you know, financial amends. And you know, but again, it's the clarity around one that led me to pay her 7.5 years after I wrote the letter. Mm-hmm. You know, I was going to talk some too. You know, as far as balking points and, you know, staying connected and stuff like that, especially with 6 and 7, you know, to me it has to make sense. I've got to be able to connect some dots here. And I got to start.
Oh, good.
Yeah. But anyway, like with character defects, step 6 and 7. To me, I have to somehow relate that back to my first step. Or it just becomes an exercise in, yeah, I'd like to be a better guy. And that doesn't have enough fuel behind it, especially if there's lots of self-will involved, for me to make adjustments on my own. So anyway, you know, if I'm walking around, what is the correlation between character defects and drinking whiskey again? Well, this is the connection that I've come up with. You know, let's just throw out there, you know, a few character defects. Let's say arrogant, inability to admit wrong, juvenile, sarcastic, judgmental, moody, self-pity, and a taker. Why doesn't someone put that on their Tinder profile and see how many swipes you get? Do you see what I'm saying? If unchecked, and this is what guides me, no one's going to want to be around that person. If no one wants to be around that person, they're going to start feeling isolated. If they feel disconnected and isolated, they're going to focus a little too much on how they feel. If they focus too much on how they feel, at the end of the day, they're going to feel compelled to change the way they feel. And so they will. That's the correlation between character defects and drinking whiskey or smoking crack again. And it has to make sense to me, you know? I was going to say a couple years ago, you know, after I, with Marcia's, you know, encouragement, decided to quit working full time and essentially be mainly a stay-at-home dad, you know, Sheldon was playing football. And again, my job at this point was, you know, take care of the kids and, you know, make sure everything was, you know, I's were dotted and T's were crossed and stuff. And so Sheldon started his football game, and me and Marcia showed up to this football game, and all the kids, there was like 25 kids, and I was checking the emails, you know, regularly, but all 25 kids were wearing like a blue shirt and Sheldon wore a white one. And me and Marcia walked up, and Marcia's like, why does Sheldon have a different color shirt on than all the other kids? And I said, I have no idea. I mean, I didn't get any emails that they were supposed to wear blue, blah, blah. Anyway, long story short, Marcia got in my face, essentially, and said, why don't you do your effing job? Now, I wanted to say some things back to her that I hadn't said since we were smoking crack together. But what we did do is we went into the stands, and she immediately, you know, and you know, in my deeper spiritual self understood where she was coming from, because she's always been, you know, driven behind work and doesn't want to look, you know, like bad parents, like we dropped the ball and stuff like that. But my ego was so bruised, I wasn't able to get in touch with that at the time. So she came probably within 5 minutes and made amends to me. But me and my self-righteous anger needed her to sit with the pain a little longer. Right? So we go up into the stands, and I isolate myself. I'm sitting by myself, away from her. But see, she's already moved forward. She's been willing to make the amends. So she's sitting there with the other parents, laughing and giggling it up, which pisses me off even more. Because I'm up in the stands thinking, this is bullshit. She offended me. She was in the wrong. But I'm sitting here like a juvenile all by myself while she's enjoying the football game. This does not make sense in the world. And, you know, after the game, she tried to come again. But I still wasn't quite ready. And finally that night, you know, I called my sponsor. Probably about 10 hours too late. But, you know, what he told me is he said, Jonathan, you're absolutely right. She was 100% wrong in that situation. But you don't get to hang out in self-righteous anger. My self-righteous anger was just as dangerous as her selfish response to me when she felt like our parenting was threatened. And I tell you guys, there was such an effect produced by self-righteous anger, by being wrongfully accused.
Yes.
I mean, I'm telling you, I wasn't close, I don't think, to drinking or smoking crack that day. But if I had sat on that or multiplied it by 3 or 4 wrongdoings from other people, I could easily see how I could get blocked off and all of a sudden have a strange middle blank spot, you know? The other things that have happened, you know, especially, you know, there was some time here where, you know, again, being in recovery is about one thing and one thing only, and that's willingness to change. If you're not willing to change, you will drink and drug again.
That's right.
Guaranteed. And so one of the things that I've had to look at is some things, some character defects of my own, you know, my unwillingness / inability at times to apologize, to say I was wrong, my tone, my inflection, you know. And for a while there, you know, this is the order of progress. You can be doing that, throwing out that harm left and right, totally asleep to it. The next kind of phase of growth is awareness, right? Where, hey, I'm catching myself, I'm doing it again, and now my awareness is peaked. The problem I've seen, though, with myself and as well with people that I sponsor is that we like to camp out in awareness. Hey, I'm aware of it. You know what I mean? And the problem with that is it's kind of like if I stole your TV, but I haven't given you your TV back, but at least I'm aware that I stole your TV. How is the awareness that I stole your TV helping you watch Netflix at night? It's not. And so I can only hang out in awareness for so long before I start being punished by not moving forward past awareness. Not by a punishing God, but by my own self-will. I'm punished by my own self-will in not trusting and relying on power enough to become intimate and vulnerable and apologize or listen to my tone or make amends quickly, right? The other thing that I was, you know, thinking about, you know, again, I know you guys have traffic problems. I've sat in it, you know, just for the last, you know, 72 hours. But Austin has horrific traffic issues as well. And what I've noticed, you know, like I said before, I work 6 or 7 days a month, which is a real dream schedule, I realize. But we live in Round Rock, which I don't know the analogy, you know, here, but it's north of North Austin, and I work downtown Austin.
Mm. It's like living in Cumming.
There you go.
Yeah,
that's what I meant to say.
Georgia.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I have to go down this crowded highway called Mopac. And it usually takes me anywhere from 45 minutes to 1 hour to get to work in the morning. What's crazy is the traffic is always consistent. But my reaction to the traffic is what differs. I can be on the same schedule, the same amount of behind, the same amount of on time, but sometimes be totally cool with the traffic and sometimes be pissed as hell. The difference that I've noticed over these last few years is, guess what happens when I'm okay with the traffic? My phone is going off and there's sponsees calling me. And I have the opportunity to think a little less of myself and a little more of someone else, and then all of a sudden the traffic doesn't bother me as much. But if I'm sitting there with just me and the radio, examining how stupid these drivers are, and why if it's raining one drop, everyone, you know, drives like there's a blizzard outside. You know, that's the difference. The opportunity to think, you know, more of others is what helps me with my character defects. You know, the other thing that I've gotten, again, my awareness has increased, but I think that I've moved into some action too around it, is trying to characterize in order of severity character defects. And I commit misdemeanors and you guys commit felonies. That's the way that it works.
Yes.
And what I realized is that I used to, I mean, one of the character defects that has gone away from me in general is aggressive driving. I don't tailgate, I don't cut people off, I let people in and stuff like that. And so my selfishness behind driving is a lot more attenuated than it was. But the problem is my judgment about the current people that are driving selfishly is through the roof. Now, in my mind, my judgment about them driving selfishly is not as severe as the selfish driving in and of itself.
Right.
But the problem is, who am I to judge what blocks me off from God? My judgment about the people that drive the way I used to blocks me off just as much as if I was tailgating and flipping people off. Either way, I'm playing God, and either way, I'm in my own way. I can't get connected to power. You know, I'm going to wrap up with this, and then I'll let, you know, Marcia finish this up. But the other thing that I've noticed that's very, very helpful, I know that I've talked to a couple people today and over the last couple of days that have a problem with, you know, what happens is I get up spiritually asleep and I have to have my coffee and do my readings. And then I get on the beam and then I go out the door and then all of a sudden I'm way off in left field. Now I got to get back on track. And lots of times what I end up doing with the morning, you know, meditation and the nightly review is I try and clean up 15 hours worth at the end of the night. And who I can get way off track and cause a whole lot of freaking harm by the time 12 or 15 hours pass. So one of the 10th step practices that I use and I give to lots of my the guys and girls I sponsor is this hourly assignment where I get up in the morning and as soon as I wake up, I set my alarm on my watch for 60 minutes. And when it goes off in 60 minutes, I press reset. And what happens is I get 12 or 15 spot checks throughout the day rather than trying to clean up all the damage I caused 15 hours later. And the spot checks look like this. I might get up at, you know, 6:30, 7:30, 8:30, 9:30. Every single time it goes off, I ask myself, where's my thought life? What am I thinking about? Am I being judgmental? Am I thinking about myself? Am I thinking of others? Am I inconveniencing myself? Right? Where are my character defects? Am I thinking about God? Am I thinking lustful thoughts? Right? And what I found is, on the days that I do that, the harms that I've created by the end of the day are a lot smaller than if I try and go just, you know, balls to the wall from my morning meditation until the evening review, and then try and clean up everything. Because the truth is, too, I fall asleep and I forget stuff. If I can break down my day into 12 or 15 increments rather than just one total increment at the end of the day, I find that it's a little easier to stay on point and to stay connected and try and stay more present in the moment. So those are all things that I can do, you know what I mean, to try and stay connected to my, you know, powerlessness. You know, I'm blessed again because I don't work full time to have 3 hours a week devoted to teaching Big Book, meeting with newcomers, right? That's one of the ways that I can stay connected to my first step. You know, Mark and Joe used to even talk about, you know, if you're having a hard time remembering, sometime in your morning meditation, just sit with, now that I'm 10 years sober, what would it be like to just have one hit of crack? No more, no less. And see how that makes you feel. Right? Maybe now that 10 years has passed, I can smoke crack recreationally. Maybe I could drink just 2 shots of whiskey a night to help me go to sleep, but no more. And just sit with that. Go back. Contemplate what that must be like, what that would be like right now. Am I still an alcoholic? Am I still an addict? Do I still need God? Do I still suffer from lack of power at times? Right? And the last thing I was going to say is, you know, in a recovered life, there are no divisions. Everything is unified. Because what my mind likes to say is, maybe I could look at something I shouldn't be looking at on the internet if I pick up a couple more sponsees. Or maybe I could cheat on my taxes if I pick up an extra H&I. Everything bleeds into the other. A recovered life is a unified life. And ideally, the goal is, I roll at Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu the same way that I drive in traffic, the same way I treat my children, the same way I treat my wife, the same way I treat strangers, the same way I show up in a meeting. That's the goal. Not to have 17 different stage characters stone cold sober. And I can't compensate for dishonesty or self-will in one area of my life by doubling down in another area of my life. It doesn't work that way. I can't cheat in this area of my life and expect it to stay contained. It will bleed out, and I'll become spiritually sick, I'll become blocked off, and I'll drink whiskey and smoke crack again. So.
Thank you. We're about to wrap up, and then we'll take some questions at the end. But while Jonathan was talking, one of the things that I was thinking about that is imperative in order to stay in recovery, to stay happy, joyous, and free, and not to lose touch with your first step, is consistency. Mm-hmm. Over the last 5 or 6 years, we have had experience watching some of what we call our litter mates drop off. You know, people that we got sober with, people that were kind of like in our network, you know, in Austin. And when you talk to them, whether they come back into the rooms or whether they stay out, and one of the people that I'm thinking about right now is still out. We were trying to get him into detox last week. When you think about, like, what's the difference? They're sitting in the same meetings we're sitting in. They had gnarly first steps, too. So what's the difference? Like, why are we sitting here? And he's currently locked up in his house at this moment smoking crack. And when he had a lucid interval, what he was talking to me about was that he was a sprinter. Recovery is a marathon race. It's a marathon race. It's not a sprint. It's not a, I'm so full of gung-ho, you know, let's issue ourselves a sword and a shield and a badge, and we're going to go, you know, like, get everybody into AA or CA and then go back to drinking again. But that's what you see a lot, you know. That's what you see a lot. And I was listening to a speaker tape the other day. If you never heard it, send me a text or an email, and I'll shoot you a link to it. It's Blonde Dave talking about the 11th step. It's powerful. It's one of the best 11th step talks I've ever heard. Blonde Dave's this guy from Texas. And he was talking about, we talk about the principles behind the 12 steps, you know, honesty, courage. But he said that the real underlying principle behind every single step is humility. And I really sat with that, and I really thought about that, and that's true. In order to stay consistent, I have to stay in humility. And a really good working definition of humility is the allness of God and the nothingness of self. So if I'm staying in humility, what does that mean in terms of my consistent action? It means I stay consistent with my prayer and meditation. It means I stay consistent with my inventory. It means I make all my amends. It means I stay consistent in a step 10 and make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone. It means I stay consistent with my nightly review. And I consistently go and help others, and I consistently practice principles in all of my affairs. You know, there's a saying in Texas, chop wood, carry water, and that was like a Mark Houston thing. It means basically, you know, just do the next right thing that's in front of you and let God take care of the rest. But I saw on Facebook the other day this thing that said, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. That made me think about as I was getting sober. And then it said, after enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. And in my humble opinion, the second part of that is the more difficult thing to do. During the break, Lindsay came up to me and told me, she said, did you see that guy that came up to the door? And I was like, yeah, I thought he was like a caterer or something. I was like, what, are we going to have dinner here? I was thinking that because he had on that white suit, you know. She's like, no, we heard Jonathan speak last night at the Log Cabin Group. He was working all day today, so he couldn't come to this, but he had a 30-minute lunch break, and he rushed over here, and he only had 10 minutes, but he wanted to get Jonathan's phone number before he had to rush back and go to work. See, he's really connected to his first step. He's got 5 days. He's desperately seeking. He's desperately seeking, and I remember what that felt like. And it was so easy to feel so motivated back then to do things like that. I can remember when I was in treatment, the thing going around treatment at the time was people that ride the bus stay sober. So we just freaking like rode the bus just to ride the bus, you know? Like we'd pass up a perfectly good ride in someone's car to get on the bus to go to a meeting because we were so driven and so hungry and so thirsty for recovery, right? But these days, the more difficult thing to do is to stay consistent. You know, Jonathan was talking about it, I think, Thursday night. Like, in early recovery, there's so many fireworks, you know? Like, that guy's coming over here. He's all excited. He's going to get Jonathan's phone number. He's going to call him tomorrow. Jonathan's going to give him some kick-ass assignments. He's going to do his inventory. He's going to have a real experience. He's going to make his amends. He's going to get his kids back. He's going to get a better car. He's going to get a promotion. And right? And that's what happens. But what happens 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years later? You wake up in the morning, do your prayer and meditation, go to work, try not to step on anyone's toes. You go to your home group at night, you might meet with a sponsee before or after that. You come home, you feed your kids dinner, they're all there, you tuck them in the bed, you go to bed, oh my God, I'm so tired, I don't want to do my nightly. You do your nightly anyway. You know, if you're lucky like me, you have a partner that's in recovery and, you know, he'll tease me. You know, are you going to do your weeklies? Stuff like that. But it's important, you know. The people that I see that don't make it are the people that come in like a shotgun, and they die off like a fizzle. Mm-hmm. The people that I see make it are the people that suit up and show up no matter what. And they make a conscious and an intentional effort to stay close to the inner circle of recovery and to stay close to their first step by continuously helping others and surrounding themselves by people that they have spiritual consent with to hold up a mirror to their alcoholism and their addiction. You know? It's kind of like that, if you've ever seen those National Geographic shows where they show like the wildebeest that are coming, you know, across the plains in Africa or whatever, and the lion or the leopard or the cheetah or whatever is like sitting over there like crouched down, ready to pounce on them. The ones that get picked off are the ones that are on the outside. The ones that stay safe are the ones that stay on the inside of the pack. And that's why it's important in our own lives to have accountability around us, to have a home group, you know, to have a sponsor, to have a network of people. People always say, like, you know, new sponsees ask me, like, well, how will I know when it's my home group? And I said, well, you'll know when you start going to group conscience meetings and you start having service. And most importantly, that people notice when you're not there.
Mm-hmm.
If no one is noticing when you're not there, something's wrong. We've got to be known. We've got to be known. Alcoholism and addiction are diseases of isolation and perception. If my perception can get skewed enough that it feels like, you know, it's all about me again and everyone's out to get me, I'm going to isolate. And if alcohol and dope can get me alone enough for long enough to feel as miserable as I need to feel for the mental obsession to return, then it's done its job. We have a disease that wants us dead, but will settle for us drunk or high or miserable or full of shame. So that's all I've got, I think. It's been wonderful to be here with you all today. I guess we'll take some questions, but thank you all again for the opportunity. Do you have anything else? Yes, ma'am.
Hello. This whole day was just wonderful. Thank you for your service. Mm. Great thing that you do, bringing all this to groups around the world. This is my question. My name is Judy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Judy.
Hey, Judy.
In the scenario where you're at the ball game, and you say something, and let's say you are not in the program,
mm-hmm.
and she says something bad to you, you say something bad to her.
Mm.
So a little while later, she apologizes to you, but you're not in the program, so you don't have this concept that we're talking about. So what does she do then with her hurt feelings?
About him holding me sort of emotionally hostage?
That's on you.
Well, I mean, you know, I would do the same thing that I did. You know, right after that happened, you know, I called my sponsor. She didn't answer, so I called my friend that's in my network that I can also 10-step with, which is important. And I told her what happened, and she asked me, so what fear was driving you to say that? And I said, well, the fear that I'm going to look like a mom who's not taking care of her kids.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, you know, helped me to trace that back to my fear. My feelings, my history, that it didn't have anything to do with him. And so, just to the extent that, you know, he didn't say anything to me. He just went off and wouldn't accept my apology.
I pouted.
He pouted, which was terrible. I mean, that was more painful to me because I can't stand conflict. But even if he had said, F you, or, you know, you do it, or, you know, if you were home more, then this, whatever. Even if he had said something to me, right, what does the book say? I stepped, driven by fear, I stepped on his toes, and he retaliated, seemingly without provocation. So, I mean, the inventory process would have been the same, and even if he had said something nasty to me back, I still would have owed him an amends for saying something to him that was nasty based on my own fear.
But wouldn't you have expected an apology from him also?
Well, I mean, you can wish in one hand and then in the other. I mean, whether or not, you know, that's like we were talking about earlier today, I suffer from the delusion that I'm going to be happy and satisfied if I can manage his behavior well. You know, my job is to make me okay. And just to the extent that my internal condition is mandated by what he's doing, am I in deep trouble?
Mm-hmm.
I know. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thanks, Judy.
JD, I'm going to add it.
Hey, JD.
I love what you said about the spot inventory. Because I was having anger issues early on, and I cussed out a Dairy Queen guy and my wife. My sponsor suggested set your alarm every 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing that, and that was annoying me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was helping. It was helping.
Yeah.
Because I would... He teaches me to look at people like they're mentally brain cancer, like my ex-wife.
Mm-hmm.
We can't have a conversation without an adult conversation. And I get irritated and just very mad at her. She attacks me, and I know you talked about that some, how to handle it, and I still have trouble with that, even though I do my spot checks. And then I want to do the justifiable anger. Mm-hmm. Well, she accused me of this and that. And that. Mm-hmm. If you could expand on that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
How can I expand on that?
Well, you're the expert at justifiable anger.
That's true. Well, you know, it's kind of like the same thing that Judy was asking Marcia, is just in reverse.
Right.
You know, I mean, if I'm counting on her not ever saying anything that would trigger justifiable anger within me, then I'm in the results business. Mm-hmm. And I can't control her or my ex-wife or my children or the people that work for me or anything like that any more than I can, you know, control anyone else on the planet. So my job at the end of the day is, again, to number one, be aware of self-righteousness and realize that if that's an island I want to camp out on, I'm more than welcome to do that.
Right.
But at the end of the day, I'm not punishing her, which was evidenced by her having fun in the stadium when I was sitting there with my thumb up my ass being pissed. That, even though she said something hurtful, the reason I felt the way I felt was because of my self-righteousness, not because of what she said. So at the end of the day, I'm responsible for my freedom. She's responsible for hers. I mean, and I would never have it another way. I'm glad that, you know, we're both in recovery and we both, you know, practice, you know, principles and you know, or kind of try to be ruled by spiritual motives at the end of the day. If I went around my life looking for opportunities to be justifiably angered, I mean, kill me now. You know? I mean, I'd be drunk and high in a second. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's just about, you know, me and my relationship with God, me and my relationship with power. How badly do I want to rest easy at night versus how badly do I want to prove to other people how right I am?
And I'll add to that, it's human nature to hold other people to a higher standard than we hold ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I want mercy for me and justice for what he did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, mm-hmm. I'm going to give myself a pass.
Yeah.
Because I know my intentions. Yeah. Right?
There you go. Yeah.
But, right. You know, part of my addiction was having all the best intentions in the world and never being able to have my actions match up to my intentions. And, you know, mm-hmm. part of recovery is bridging that gap so that my intentions match my actions.
Right.
But, you know, I know how I was feeling when I said that to him. It wasn't that I didn't think he was doing his job. It's just that I was so afraid that everyone else there was going to think that I wasn't doing mine.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think are like some of your like strengths and weakness, like of y'all being, you know, married, like playing together before and like with relapses in between and like everything that's happened in the past like 10 years since y'all got sober this time? What do you think are your strengths and weaknesses in your personal experience?
Shit, we could do a whole workshop on that. I mean, I think for me, you know, and I'll just speak for me, I think that
we've actually never talked about this.
No, yeah, but I mean, I think that I think for me, you know, I feel I can rest assured that there's nothing that life is going to throw our way that we haven't already faced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'd be one thing if we met both, you know, totally clean and sober and practicing spiritual principles in all our affairs and just rock solid and then went from there. I mean, that's great if that's your experience. But, you know, we had the experience of half-ass recovery, staying sober on fear and momentum, a really rough relapse together, and then for the last 10 years, both practicing at a high level. I have no idea how that happened. I'm very grateful that that happened. But, you know, I trust her with my life. I know she has my back. But at the same time, I think one of the strengths, too, of having visited all three areas, that I guess it's possible for a relationship to visit, is that, you know, we have emerged on the other side with some real clear boundaries. Mm-hmm. I don't sponsor her. She doesn't sponsor me. I love Marcia. She can bring a whole lot to my life. I'd be sad if she relapsed or died, but I have no question that I could stay sober and continue to help other people. Her presence adds to my life. But I think if she was gone, I could still rely on God and still help other guys and still be involved in fellowship and stuff like that. So, what about you?
I agree with that. I mean, I think those are all strengths that, you know, there's a rock solidness to our relationship, you know. And I feel like I can trust Jonathan to be honest with me, even when it's something that might be difficult for me to hear. Above anyone else on the planet, he can see into my behavior, you know, and he can check me when I invite him to do that, which is, you know, not all the time. But if I invite him and, you know, what do you think about this? What do you see? I trust his judgment. Mm-hmm. I think one of the weaknesses would be that if we get on the same team against something or somebody, it can be real brutal, you know. we can co-sign each other, you know, like real hard. And so we have to be really careful of that, because we have this sort of Bonnie and Clyde history. Mm-hmm. So we have to be really careful that we don't, you know, allow our addiction to show up in that way. Because, you know,
we like to co-judge.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It takes a partner to judge real effectively.
It takes two to properly.
Yeah. So, you know, we like to put our judgments together and, you know, see what comes out on the other side. I mean, that's... You know, that can be dangerous, but...
I think there's way more benefits than weaknesses, strengths than weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's something that I believe that we are uniquely qualified to help other couples, which is also mm-hmm. a strength. We're going to do a workshop in Texas, is it this August?
Mm-hmm.
This August, about spiritual principles in relationships, mm-hmm. which we could talk for 2 hours about that.
Mm-hmm.
But... we are very clear that it's very important for us to keep those in our relationship.
And there's lots of things that have changed. You know, I remember when I was going to meetings based on fear and momentum and a belief in God and a desire to stay sober. I mean, things like jealousy. And some guys and girls probably could identify with this. You know, we would go to meetings, and after the meetings, you know, you all circle up and hold hands. But I'd be real cognizant of who she ended up holding hands with. And if it was the same guy and I felt intimidated, or like he might be better looking than me, or, you know, bigger than me, or, you know, more charismatic than me, then I'd have a problem. You know what I mean? And I would get up and, like, purposefully go to, nope, we're going to hold hands today. You know what I mean? Just, you know, I mean, and now she travels all over the place. I mean, she's gone, you know, quite a bit of the time. And I can't tell you the last time that I felt jealous or insecure. You know, and some of that's age, I think, and some of it's longevity of relationship. But I think the majority of it is a real dependence and reliance on God. Mm-hmm. And a real blowing up of self-reliance and thinking. You know, we didn't get into fear inventory a lot, but what we both agree on is that the scarier it is, the stronger the tendency to rely on self, which is the exact opposite of what I need to be doing, right? And it's like a vicious cycle. But we both have had experiences with what happens when I, you know, mount all my forces to combat what I'm totally petrified will happen. 9 times out of 10, the thing I was trying to prevent in the first place using all my self-will ends up materializing. If I'm totally jealous of Marcia and not trusting and stuff like that, to the point where I'm checking emails or texts or where were you and stuff like that, at the end of the day, what's that going to do to the person on the other end?
they're going to be like, deuces, see ya, right? And the whole thing that I was trying to prevent is what actually happens. The same thing about money. If I'm constantly looking at my money and keeping a, you know, my arms around my money, I guarantee you my money will leave. You know? So lots of it's trial and error, and lots of it is just, you know, life experience. But there's a lot, again, it's all about willingness to change. And if you would have convinced me, you know, I mean, I think also part of the her being jealous of me and me being jealous, you know, about her has to do with how we met.
Yeah.
I mean, if you meet at drug and alcohol rehab, 2 days sober, I mean, that's what you're going to be bringing into the relationship.
Fishing, you know, in the swamp.
Right. I mean, this thing had to evolve, you know, it had to evolve.
And it's been painful. I mean, it's 16 years.
Yeah. I mean, it's a long time. So... Anyone else? Yes, sir.
Zach Fanatic. Thank
hey,
you
guys. Hey, Zach.
Thank you all both for your service. Jonathan, when you were talking about like the moving from the awareness to the action phase, you mentioned your tone and inflections, which first of all...
That question should be to me.
Okay. Both you guys have totally shown up in our relationship. Thank you for even mentioning those.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if you could share some of your experience moving into the action with stuff like that and more sort of stuff. And then I'd love to hear your experience too.
I'm seeing
No, I'll just
I think you probably
that.
Hear my experience from your significant other.
Yeah.
Marcia doesn't need to speak on this. I'll answer. No, I mean, it's a long and tedious process, you know, and it's such BS because, I mean, it's just my mind talking to me. Not once have I ever apologized to Marcia and have her say anything close to, "Ha, I knew you were a wussy. You're not a real man." But in my mind, that's what's on the table every single time.
Yeah.
Not once has that ever happened. But that's the fear that drives me. And, you know, so I think that's that, you know, especially over the last few years, again, staying present to the moment helps you get at it at the moment. You know, again, if I'm asleep during the day, I have to think back, oh yeah, I spoke harshly, blah, blah, blah. If I'm able to stay present to the moment, I can correct it a lot faster. But it's not a thing where, you know, 6 months and 3 days ago I was talking mean and then, you know, the next day I quit. You know, but I can tell you this, that there has been movement, and I think she would testify to this, from the awareness to more action. I can't remember the last time that I, you know, that I barked at her or said something to where she said something like, "I really wish that you'd watch your tone with me." It's been a while. And I'm not saying that we don't, you know, have arguments. I mean, we do. But I think God has helped me to outgrow that fear. I still have the fear, and nowhere in the books does it say that I'm going to be free of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Fear is the human condition because self-reliance is the human condition. But I'm able to act despite those fears. And, you know, part of it might have been writing that, you know, love letter a few years ago to her for Valentine's Day. You know?
Did you talk about that today?
No, I don't think so. But, yeah, I mean, just for anyone that didn't hear, you know, a few years ago, I asked Marcia on Valentine's Day what she would want. I'd saved some money. I said, "You go to jewelry, we'll take you out to eat, you know, and go on a trip, anything. And she's like, "Yeah, I know what I want. I want you to write me a love letter." And I was like, "Did you hear what I said?" Jewelry, dinner, a trip, anything. And she said, "Oh, no, I heard what you said. I want you to write me a love letter. And not only do I want you to write it, then I want you to read it to me."
Aww.
And I'm like... I quit crack too early. You know, that was my first thought. But I mean, I did that. And I mean, how sad that the love of my life, I wouldn't feel comfortable writing a letter and then reading it out loud to her. What old ideas would dictate the fear behind that? So I wrote it and I read it. And she also asked to go out to dinner, so it was like I read it at dinner at the restaurant. But, you know, the point is, that letter is still on her nightstand.
I mean, she liked, you know what I mean?
It's actually in my big book.
In your big book, yeah. Now, put that under the heading of things that Jonathan would never ask for, right? I'm never going to ask for that, but that was important for her, you know? And I was willing to do it and to be uncomfortable, you know? Someone told me a long time ago, my job on a daily basis is to act better than I feel. And at the end of the day, if I've acted better than I felt, then I've had a winning day, right? So you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, I will testify. It has gotten better, you know, over the years. I think, like, the mistake I made early on was thinking and taking it personally when Jonathan would, you know, speak in a tone that I interpreted as mean or harsh or condescending or, you know, whatever, scary. And so just over time, as I have learned to ask for more for what I need, you know, I need you to be intimate with me. I need you to be vulnerable with me. I think he's felt safer to do that because I think all of our fear is that we're going to get punked or played or, you know, whatever, fill in the blank, your fear of abandonment, rejection, those sort of top five fears that we all have. And I think as he has become more God-reliant in his recovery, and I have become more God-reliant in being able to ask him for what it is that I need in our relationship, he's felt more comfortable being vulnerable and being intimate. And as a side effect, you know, that tone stuff that was really just a way for him to protect his fear has settled down some. Mm-hmm. Why, you know, the book says, why do we have this fear? Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Well, if he's going to, you know, show up like this, you know, an attempt to hide his fear of being vulnerable, you know, that's, it's sort of a self-defeating proposition.
I'm an alcoholic. And this may be more of a thank you than posing the question, because I'm not sure how to ask the question, but I just wanted to say that I've heard many different spins and takes and perspectives on having a relationship with God, and I just absolutely, when you were talking about when you were talking about, you know, that you had been abused by your stepfather and looking at God as, you said that you looked at God as
unavailable?
Both unavailable, but there was another word you used. You said that
betrayed.
Betrayed. One more. Keep going.
I don't remember.
That was a perfect word that I loved that you had said. You said that you looked at God as something that was not unavailable, but I'll help me with this because it was perfect.
Inaccessible. Unapproachable.
All of those.
Sounds like.
It sounds like. No, act it out, right? Something that was you were afraid. It was almost like something that was not unapproachable. I had the question in my head, and now all of a sudden it's gone. Don't you hate when you kill brain cells?
Mm-hmm.
It was like, I'm sorry, I've lost it now. But it was something to all of that. You know, it was something that you were afraid to approach God because you. Oh, for God's sake. Well, yeah, it was like, I can't believe it's gone. Move on to something else later.
We'll come back to you.
Oh, I thought you were here. Okay. Anyone that's too shy can always come up to us afterwards, too. Either one of us. And Lindsay, Caitlin have both of our numbers and emails and stuff like that, so if we can be of any help, it sure has been nice hanging out with you guys for the last 3 days, and thank you guys for having us.